listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello, I'm Rob Daly. This is Football in Europe, your weekly European football podcast. Lots to discuss this week. We're going to be talking about the troubles at Bastia as some of their fans attacked Lyon players on Sunday night. We're going to be looking ahead to some of the Champions League as well, letting you know how Tony Adams got on in his first game in charge of Granada. But first of all, to talk about all things Serie A, we're joined by BT Sport commentator Adam Summerton. Adam, thank you for joining us from a sunny Gateshead or non-sunny Gateshead?
It is quite sunny, actually. Yeah, I've just pulled up here doing a game here today. Yeah, it's very nice, actually. It's pleasantly surprised. I thought I'd need to be wrapped up.
Well, you have a varying career, Adam, because obviously you cover live non-league football on BT and Serie A. I mean, that we're going yeah, completely into the spectrum there. And we've got to talk about the Milan derby. I really enjoyed this game on Saturday. A kickoff time, I think, to favour perhaps the Chinese market, but that everyone was treated to a thriller, Adam.
It was the same scoreline as it was in the reverse fixture, 2-2 earlier this season. And it's interesting that you mentioned the Chinese audience, because it was, the first game where both clubs have been under Chinese ownership after the takeover at Milan during the week. And it was a 12:30 kickoff time, the earliest time that game's ever kicked off. And of course, in the Far East, that works out quite nicely in terms of a kickoff time for attracting a big audience, because I think it was about 6:30 in the evening, Beijing time.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah,
Clearly, I don't think that's a coincidence, which perhaps it was. And it meant that a lot of people have done the maths with all of this. And I know that one of the papers in Italy, they worked out that they felt it was a record TV audience globally for any Serie A match ever, over 800 million people. So as they're looking to market Serie A, they couldn't really have asked for anything much better in terms of a spectacle. I mean, even the sun was shining. It was a beautiful day, a full house, dramatic game. It couldn't really have gone much better for the league as a brand, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it could have gone a lot better for Inter, of course, because they were 2-0 up, but by half-time, Icardi and Candreva on the score sheet. I didn't think Milan were that bad first half, but they did manage to turn it around. A 97th minute equaliser as well, Adam. From a contrary point of view, I know that when you're not sure if it's gone over the line, that's not very helpful, but the goal line technology sort of helps us out now, doesn't it?
It did, but there was still that kind of little bit, like almost a second, where there was still that moment of doubt. As you're looking at the reaction of the players, you're looking at the reaction of the referee. And what the referee did, Orsato, as the Inter players came over to immediately to protest, he just kept pointing at his wrist and said, "Well, no, it's a goal. This tells me it's a goal." So of course, then there was pandemonium in San Siro, and it was just an astonishing end. You know, Inter, I should point out, are saying there should never have been. It shouldn't have gone on that long, because it was almost 97 minutes on the clock. The referee had indicated a minimum of five, or fourth official had indicated a minimum of 5 minutes. There were some things that happened, stoppages in added time, and the referee did keep pointing at his watch when Milan was saying, "Are you adding this on?" So Inter say too much without it was added on. Milan say it was right. They're never going to agree, but it certainly made for an incredible drama.
Yeah, it really did. From 2-0 down, it finished 2-2 at San Siro. Great result for AC Milan. And the new ownership looked very happy in the stands, Adam, because this deal to take over, I mean, twice they've delayed the payment, the Chinese consortium. It would appear that they've had to take out some additional loans as well to make the deal happen.
Yeah. They have, as we understand it. It's a very, very complicated transaction, one which I'm not qualified to completely explain to everybody. I hold my hands up on that, but I do know it is complicated. And as you say, they've had to, in order to get it over the line, they've had to borrow a significant amount of money. And, you know, I think it's quite clear that there are those associated with Milan on the outside, some former players and some supporters who have expressed concerns. And I think that's inevitable when, you know, people who they don't really know are coming in and buying this gigantic football club. Let's make no bones about it. This is one of the biggest clubs in world football. Well, certainly one of the most written about, most talked about, most decorated. And it's changed hands. And there is going to be a period of adjustment, clearly. And I know that Maldini has in the past expressed his concerns, I think probably is fair to say, about how this is all panning out and whether it's the right thing. We'll only know in the fullness of time. I think I said during the commentary at the weekend, when the camera was continually going to the new directors in the stands, you know, one of the first things that they've said is, look, we're targeting a return to the Champions League. Once we're back in the Champions League, then we're targeting being one of the top five clubs in world football again. Well, that's fine, but actions will speak louder than words. And I think that's the... what, you know, Milan supporters will only believe it when they truly see it. And if it is correct that they've had a lot of help in terms of loans, high interest loans, we're told as well, in order to get this over the line, how will that affect them in terms of their ability to compete in the transfer market this summer? Because everyone's looking now for them to show their intentions in who they bring into the club in the transfer market, and also the Milan better players, some very young promising players as well. Can they get their new contracts? The most pressing one is Donnarumma. His deal runs out in 2018. He's due an enormous pay rise because there's plenty of clubs out there that would be willing to pay him a huge amount of money. People are saying that they will show their true intentions in how they negotiate with his agent, Viola, over that extension. So that is certainly something to watch, as is the future of Montella. I think they'd be mad to let him go. I think a lot of Milan fans would think that as well. One of the most important things they can do for me is get him tied down to a long-term deal.
That was going to bring
a
us on
new
to...
long-term deal.
Yeah, I mean, that brings us very nicely onto our next question, Adam, which a couple have come in from listeners as well. Jonathan Stephen wants to know, says, as stupid as it would be, is he expecting both the Milan-based managers to be replaced in order to get a big name? Many saw Pioli as a stopgap at Inter. Montella's doing a good job at AC Milan. But in terms of, say, the category of manager that Jonathan might be hinting at there, you Ancelotti, Mourinho, Pep Guardiola, that type of character. Do you see either club making a change in the summer?
I think it's more likely at Inter than it is at Milan. I think that Pioli was getting, quite rightly, a lot of plaudits for the turnaround that he'd brought about after replacing Frank de Boer. What a chaotic start to the season it was for Inter, with Mancini leaving so soon before the start of the season. De Boer brought in, having obviously been at Ajax previously. And the players just didn't seem to buy into what De Boer was looking to achieve. I think it was perhaps right club, wrong time for Frank De Boer. And it led to more instability after all the transfer activity they'd done during the summer as well. And he came into a very difficult situation, Pioli, and I thought he did brilliantly to turn it around, particularly defensively. They improved immeasurably defensively. But now they've had this run where they've gone four without a win. Going into the Milan derby, they'd had back-to-back defeats against Samp and Crotone. Obviously, Pioli has come under a great deal of criticism for the changes that he made in the closing stages of the derby. A lot of people suggesting that it was his changes that invited pressure from Milan and actually ended up into dropping the points. Mm. So I think that he is under pressure. And if they don't qualify for the Europa League, I think that would be almost certainly lead to a managerial change. Even if they did sneak into the Europa League, I still think there would be a question mark there. In terms of Milan and Montella, I've just written a piece actually on Football Italia where I've kind of tried to justify why I think that Montella should stay. And I think that he's done an absolutely unbelievable job in what is such a transitional period for Milan this season, to come in and manage that transition as effectively as he has, with showing great constraint in terms of what he said in the media as well. Not had much money to spend. I think 17 million euros that they've spent. Compare that to 95 million euro in the same period for Inter. But yet Milan, I think it's 8 points better off compared to this time last year, whereas Inter, I think it's 2 points back. You know, he's won their first silverware since 2011, the Supercoppa Italiana. He's helped, I think, manage the careers of their important young players like Donnarumma and Locatelli and Calabria and Suso, and we could mention a couple of others as well. Romagnoli's another one. I just think he's created the environment in difficult circumstances now for Milan, once the financial investment begins to kick in, for them to really move on. And I think he is the right man to take them to the next level.
Ed Byrne has pointed out on Twitter, he said to us, I've not watched Serie A since the Channel 4 AC Jimbo days, of course, James Richardson days. Watched the Milan derby. He said, when did Italian football become so exciting and fast-paced? And while many are backing Juve to comfortably, defensively see out that scoreline against Barcelona, Adam, Serie A has been thrilling for most of the games I've seen this season.
Yeah. it's a brilliant league. It's great to watch. The tempo of the derby was pretty much unrelenting. I compare the pace of many of the games that I've covered this season to a Premier League pace. And, you know, it always makes me smile because there are still a lot of people out there who like, was it Ed you said who texted?
Yeah,
texted,
yeah.
Who haven't watched Serie A. I mean, I used to watch it back in the 90s. I loved the coverage of James Richardson. And it's amazing that there are still so many people who still think that it's all about Catenaccio and it's all really defensive and, you know, it's 1-0 and 1-1 scorelines. It couldn't have changed more, really. I think the defensive standard clearly slipped. It's nowhere near as good. But what it has led to is some wonderful attacking football. And we have a situation in terms of the golden boot in Italy. I mean, you've got, I think there's still about six players going for it. I think there's, off the top of my head, I think there's four or five who've got 20 goals or over. You know, Belotti, Icardi, Mertens, I think Immobile might have 18, Higuain. I know I'll be forgetting somebody, but it's unbelievable, really, the amount of goals. It's right up there with the Premier League in terms of the average goals scored per game. Right up there. So it's a great league to watch, it really is.
Juventus complete their Champions League mission in the week against Barcelona, 3-0 up from the first leg. Dybala should be okay, we understand, Adam, after he got munched by Sully Mentari on a couple of occasions, a couple of occasions in their 2-0 win over Pescara at the weekend. I mean, he'd be a huge loss if he could not play.
It would be a big loss. I think we saw with his performance in the first leg where he lived up to his nickname or the title that they've given him as La Joya, the Jewel, and that's certainly what he is. I mean, I think he's good enough to potentially be going forward a Ballon d'Or contender. He's fantastic. And the way that he has made the transition, not just from Palermo to Juve, but in the first instance, people forget that he went from an Argentinian second division team before he went to Palermo. I remember when they signed him, Zamperini, the then president of Palermo, said, you know, we're signing the new Sergio Aguero. And inevitably, when anyone says the new so-and-so, you know, everybody thinks of a bit of skepticism, really. But now Zamperini sort of goes after the Barca game. He said, no, forget the new Aguero. He's the new Messi. So, you know, that's how well he's...
You don't need to do that well to the lad, eh?
Yeah, look, he's a wonderful, wonderful talent. I think the other thing to say about his transition from Palermo to Juve is that he did that almost seamlessly, effectively ended up replacing his fellow countryman Tevez. You know, to replace a player of the calibre of Tevez with the energy that he brought, that's what they were losing when Tevez left. He replaced that energy, that endeavour, dipping around all the time and giving him his quality as well. But also, Rob, as you have to do if you're ever going to be a success in his current Juventus setup, you have to buy into the mentality, the winning mentality of the club. Never ever satisfied, always want more, and that's what he's bought into, and he's learnt off the mentality of senior figures around him, and he's doing brilliantly.
He absolutely has. So a win for Juve at the weekend. Roma, meanwhile, were held to a 1-1 draw with Atalanta. So Juve, 8 clear now with 8 to go. It looks like the Bianconeri have wrapped up the title. Adam, there's one thing I just wanted to ask of you very quickly. After I've given the latest from Spain, a 90th-minute winner from Isco secured a 3-2 victory for Real Madrid at Sporting Gijon at the weekend. Calls now for Isco to start against Bayern in the Champions League of the week. Real Madrid stay 3 clear despite Barcelona's 3-2 home win over Sociedad. Barca most likely heading out the Champions League, although you can't write them off, of course. Granada, meanwhile, as you probably saw, appointed Tony Adams as their new manager last week after sacking Lucas Alcaraz. He obviously, the likes of Richardson and Ria Coke have been training there. They didn't feature as they were beaten 3-0 by Celta Vigo at home. It would appear relegation's on the cards for them, regardless of Tony Adams' wonderful dance moves, as you may have seen in his latest training session. Adam, my tenuous tie in it. Did you see the Tony Adams thing, by the way?
I saw the dancing, yeah, on the training ground, yeah.
I still don't quite know what he's doing.
I covered Portsmouth for a season, the time when he, both when he was assistant to Redknapp and also when he ended up taking over himself. And he's just such an extrovert, isn't he? You just never know what he's going to come out with next or what he's going to do next. And he's got a big job on his hands there. I think it's an almost impossible job, isn't it, to keep them up. But he's had plenty of experience, varied experience as a coach now, hasn't he? He's been all over the place.
Yeah, a truly bizarre career to match the bizarre suits that he somehow, I don't know where he's buying those things. Adam, my tenuous tie-in from La Liga back to Serie A is that Barcelona this week, sporting director Robert Fernandez confirmed to Catalan TV that the club are trying to re-sign De La Feu. They have a buyback on him from Everton, something we understand around 12 million euros. He's been on loan at AC Milan, started the derby. Felt he was a touch erratic actually in his performance when he got into the final third in the derby. But De La Feu back to Barcelona, set to happen. Can you understand Barcelona's logic there?
Well, I think the fees clearly, for you know, in modern day terms, 12 million euro for him, I think would be a very good piece of business. So if they're looking to bring him in terms of fleshing out the squad, I can understand it. But there's no way, in my view, that he starts on a regular basis for Barcelona. I think the move to him to Milan has been very good for him. It's got him back in the Spain squad. He hadn't played for Spain since his debut in 2014 and scored on his return. So, I mean, it's got him back in the picture there. And he has done well at Milan. Don't get me wrong. He's been one of the better players at Milan since he came into the side. But there is still, for me, he isn't consistent enough. I know he plays in a position where it's hard to be consistent. But if you're talking about the very, very top bracket of football club in the world, which they are, Barcelona, I feel he's still outside of that bracket. But 12 million euro if he's a squad player, I can still see. I know it sounds like I'm contradicting myself here, but I can see why that's their intention for it. But is he good enough to go into, you know, a front three? Could he rival players like, you know, Neymar and Messi and Suarez in terms of getting into a front three? Absolutely not, no.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Enjoy Gateshead.
I will, yeah. Looking forward to it. Lincoln could well win the league today, the National League. What a story they've been this season. So if they win and Tranmere don't, then they've won the league. So it could be quite a big day in Gateshead.
Juventus and Lincoln closing in on titles. Adam, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure as always.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
Okay, joining us for part two of Football in Europe, it is Bundesliga authority, Kevin Hatchard. Kevin, hello and welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be back, Rob. Glad to be back.
You were on Danny Kelly's Trans Europe Express on Sunday night. We're both friends of the show, and I'm glad to have you on to regurgitate content.
Excellent. Always happy to do that, especially for a friend.
Hey, it's going to be beautiful regurgitation because we're talking about the Bundesliga and most notably RB Leipzig, who've secured that Champions League spot. We will talk about Bayern's Champions League prospects and about Dortmund as well and the events of the past week. But Leipzig have done it, Kev, and what a way to do it at the weekend as well.
Yeah, they thrashed Freiburg 4-0, and just when you thought that they might feel the pressure, they've actually gone up a gear and started stringing wins together. And if whatever you think of the way they're funded, whatever you think of the way they were created out of thin air, the youngest squad in the Bundesliga in its first ever season in Germany's top flight has secured a top four finish. And more than likely, they will go on to secure a top two finish. And by any stretch, that is an amazing achievement. You know, they have played thrilling football, fast-paced football. They've always looked to attack, always looked to score goals. And people say, well, they've thrown a lot of money at it. But actually, if you look at it, they brought in Oliver Burke, who's been a peripheral figure. Yes, Naby Keita has been sensational, but bringing a guy like that in was a risk because he was unproven at this level. So he has done marvellously well. And Timo Werner came in with a question mark over him because even though we knew he had enormous potential, he hadn't shown that he could be a consistent goal scorer. He hadn't shown that his finishing was good enough. And this season he's taken off. So you have to give the players immense credit, but you also have to give the coach huge credit too because Ralf Hasenhüttl did a marvellous job with Ingolstadt last season in a totally different way, made them ultra competitive, made them very, very difficult to beat, very solid defensively, couldn't really score many goals. And what he's proved is he's a versatile coach who can work with players of totally different skill levels.
I feel like the Champions League will put Ralf Hasenhüttl on an international stage that he hasn't seen before, and the people in wider Europe will probably start to realise what a smart coach he is.
Yeah, I think so. And I think he'll deserve that stage as well, because he's a likeable guy, but he's a real leader. He deals with the media very effectively. And he's an honest guy, and I think players like that. There's no mind games with him. There's no second-guessing. You know, players know where they stand with him, and he's quite happy to be honest. You know, he brought in Oliver Burke and said, yeah, he's very talented, but in terms of his work without the ball, he said the hard drive is empty, and he admitted that that was a massive weakness. And when you talk to Burke about it, he says, yeah, he's absolutely right, and it is taking me a while to learn that side of the game. So he's a great guy for young players to work under and be developed by. And I think we have to also look at the job that Ralf Rangnick, the sporting director, has done, because he coached the team to promotion from Bundesliga 2 last season, and he has overseen some very, very clever recruitment. And I think as a partnership, Rangnick and Hasenhüttl have done very, very well.
I mean, Naby Keita was already part of the Red Bull machine, having been at Salzburg. I saw you tweeting at the weekend that, you know, a lot of clubs are going to be looking out for Keita, and Emil Forsberg as well, who's racked up something like 4 million assists this season. Do you think Leipzig are in a position where they can reject 30, 40 million euro offers for those players and try and keep this squad together for the Champions League? Or are they, you know, going to look to do what they can do, which is turn over talent and recruit new players?
No, I think they can reject those offers. And I think they've already done a deal with Forsberg, so I expect him to stay. They're in talks with Keita about trying to extend and improve his contract. And I think they are in this, you know, we know that they're in it for marketing. You know, Red Bull, we know that. There's no getting away from that. But equally, they want to do it in the right way, and they want to develop a football club that's capable of challenging at the highest level. If you look at Red Bull Salzburg, for example, the huge disappointment from the Red Bull point of view with them is that they've had consistent success in Austria, but they've blown it in the Champions League qualifiers season after season after season. But this is a genuine opportunity now with Leipzig to build a football club that can challenge in the Champions League and that can give Bayern a run for their money at the top of the league. What's going to be very important for Leipzig now is keeping those players, because they cannot be seen as a selling club. They have to paint themselves as genuine challengers to Bayern.
Borussia Dortmund have not proved to be genuine challengers for the title this year, Kevin. I think that the top four in Germany does look pretty set, with Hoffenheim beating Gladbach at the weekend and Dortmund winning as well. You commentated on a Dortmund's victory, and given the nature of the events, what happened ahead of the Monaco game with the attack, it was always going to be a second emotional occasion in the space of a few days.
I thought it was an extraordinary performance from everyone connected with the club. Because I actually thought they were magnificent against Monaco. I know they made two really bad errors that they wouldn't normally make, but to perform in the way they did less than 24 hours after somebody had attacked their team bus in the violent way that they did, to even get within a goal of a very, very good Monaco team, I thought was a Herculean effort. I thought it was incredible what they did. And they carried that on Saturday. The fans, as you can imagine, very emotional but very supportive. We saw shirts held up with Mark Bartra on the back. Of course, Bartra was the only player to be seriously physically injured in the blast. But he, thankfully, is on the road to recovery. His arm injuries are healing, and he's expected to be back maybe by the end of the season. And I think it was important for Dortmund to kind of take those first few steps back towards normality. And I think they did themselves proud. And Frankfurt played their part too. You know, they took 4,500 fans. They played their part. And on the pitch, they did as well. It was actually a very tight game for a lot of the second half before Aubameyang got the third goal for Dortmund. His best ever season, by the way, in the Bundesliga now. And I think given the horrendous circumstances that this week has had, I think they did really well.
A thumping goal from Sokratis and a goal back for Marco Reus on his latest return from injury. Kevin, finally, do you think Dortmund and Bayern are going out of the Champions League this week? I mean, they're both a goal down after home games against Monaco and Real Madrid.
I fancy Dortmund more than I fancy Bayern. I think the one thing with Monaco that we've seen is that they let you play. And I think Dortmund will try and go toe-to-toe with them. Royce went off at half-time in the game against Frankfurt. I presume he might have felt a twinge and that was just a precaution. But if he does start the game at the Stade Louis II alongside Aubameyang, possibly Dembele or Pulisic, they've got the players that can drag this tie back in their favour. But of course, then you've got to keep Monaco out at the other end. And I think they've got 90 goals now in Liga.
Yeah,
so
that's
going to be a really hard task. I think it could be a Champions League classic, that second leg. As for Bayern, yes, Lewandowski is back, but Real are so, so strong at home. I thought they played brainlessly in the first leg after Javi Martinez had been sent off. There was no attempt to shut the game down. They went hell for leather to try and get the second goal with 10 men, which I thought was crazy against one of the best counter-attacking teams there's been in the last few years. And had it not been for Manuel Neuer, it could have been 3-4-5. So I think Real will finish that tie off. They're so strong at home and they're playing so well.
Kevin, thank you so much for appearing on the podcast. We'll get you on definitely before the end of the season. Cheers, Kevin. Thanks, mate.
Cheers, pal.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Okay, next up on Football in Europe, we're going to be talking about Liga. A couple of things to let you know about, though, across Europe at the moment. In the Eredivisie, big win for Feyenoord at the weekend. They were very nervous ahead of facing Utrecht, who are fourth in the table. But they did manage to get a 2-0 win to stay above Ajax, who beat Heerenveen 5-1. And I was speaking to Richard Connolly in the week, actually, who commentates on the Eredivisie for Sky Sports. He said that the question was put to Giovanni van Bronckhorst, the head coach of Feyenoord. You know, does your team need a psychology coach, a sort of performance coach? Such is their mental anxiety as they try and hold on to top spot in the Eredivisie. Benfica, well, they've gone 3 points clear at the top in Portugal. It's after a 3-0 win against Maritimo at the weekend. Porto could only draw at Braga. So Benfica have opened up a little bit of a gap. They do take on Sporting in the Lisbon derby soon. As Spartak, they might have wrapped up the Russian Premier League title at the weekend. They beat arguably their closest challenger, Zenit, 2-1. Alexander Semyedov with the winning goal. He was only signed in the winter break. So massive result for Spartak. And it's English coach Graham Potter has guided his side, Östersunds, to the Swedish Cup. They won the final 4-1. And I'm going to try and get Graham Potter on at some point. I don't know if he does interviews or anything, but I'm going to try and do that at some point. Okay, let's stop mucking about. Let's bring in Rich Allen from French Football Weekly for his first appearance on Football in Europe. Richard, we're going to be talking about French football today, and there's lots to talk about.
There's plenty, yeah. I seem to have picked quite an opportune week to make my debut.
You certainly have. So let's start. We mentioned it at the top of the show that the scenes at Bastia. So for people who didn't see it, Bastia took on Lyon on Sunday, and the game was eventually called off after fans were spilling out onto the pitch and trying to fight Lyon's players during the warm-up and during half-time. I mean, Rich, for people who haven't seen the pictures yet, it's pretty shocking.
Oh, absolutely! It's some of the most dreadful scenes I think I can remember seeing. To have players, to have perhaps most worryingly of all, evidence that stewards were also involved in this. It's unspeakable.
I mean, for people who don't know much about Bastia, I mean, they're bottom of the table now as well, and that will, I don't know if they've confirmed that will go down as a Lyon win because they had to postpone the game after the skirmishes at half time. But for people who don't know much about Bastia, they haven't been strangers to controversy in recent years and this season in particular.
No, they haven't. No, it's sadly become quite a recurring theme with Bastia. They have that sort of fierce, with them being a Corsican-based side, they have that sort of fierce island-based mentality. They're very anti-mainland, almost anti-France. And it spills over, you know, passion is one thing, but to take it to the level that they have over the last few seasons and too many times this season alone, you know, we saw at the start of the season, I think it was probably one of the first games of the season against PSG, one of the fans with like a some kind of plastic pole swinging down and just glancing Lucas Moura's head. There was partial stadium closures for that. There was then the racist chanting against Mario Balotelli not that long ago. Fines and stadium bans followed that. So this, I can only see the outcome of this being, as you say, award the victory to Lyon. There will be stadium bans, there will be fines, but there has to be points deductions now. It's gone too far, and some of those scenes were just they were just awful to see. You know, young players alike being attacked. It was Mukhtar Diakabi, the young Lyon centre back, who was victim of what appeared to be a kick from one of the stewards. So they have to be punished. It's gone on too long. Stadium closures and fines don't seem to be doing the trick.
I mean, from what I could tell, Ridge, it seemed that the Lyon players, after what happened before the game during the warm-ups, that they didn't really want to play the game at that point anyway.
No, they didn't. No, there was reports going out that they'd obviously, once that initial sort of attack on them had taken place, they'd retreated to the dressing room, and yeah, all reports were that they just didn't want to come out. There was a lengthy interviews between the coaches, the presidents, the security officials and the referees, both after that initial incident and then at half time. I think that, you know, initially then after the first incident, the talk was that let's get the game played. It may be that calms everyone down. But of course, then they got to half time. It happened again. There could only be one outcome from that, and that the game had to be called off.
Rich, was there any reason in particular that it was at the Lyon game that really kicked this off? Is it only, I suppose, that Lyon are one of the biggest French clubs around, and you mentioned mainland, archetype mainland football club or something like that. Any particular reason for Lyon?
There was a little bit, I think, of, you know, one thing I would say is Lyon fans are no saints themselves. And I think there was a little bit of mocking, I suppose, of them being these people from the island when they played the game in Lyon earlier in the season. And there was perhaps quite a worrying premonition from the then Bastia coach, Francois Cicchellini, who came out after the game, the aftermatch press conference, saying, you know, we come back to Bastia, we'll sort things out in our own way, like men, like Corsicans. And I suppose at that time people sort of laughed it off, but it seems that it's sort of rung true. And yeah, it's dreadful. You know, I was speaking to a Twitter follower of mine who's a Bastia fan and lives out there, and you know, rightfully, he wants to get across that large parts of the Bastia fans were booing those fans that were on the pitch, were completely against them. They left the ground in protest. So there are, you know, it is very much the minority, but unfortunately it's taken a new level, I suppose, of it being, you know, such an abhorrent thing to be doing.
So it looks like Bastia are going down in Ligue 1 regardless, but what are they talking about, the French media, about what the maximum punishment could be? Because I feel like when the player's safety is called into jeopardy, I mean, that's when a club can really get in great trouble.
Well, as I say, I think for me, as a minimum, there needs to be a significant penalty in terms of points deduction. If it was for me, I'm thinking, well, you know what, there's not a huge number of games left of the season. Why not consider, instead of just closing the stadium, why not bring those home, inverted commas, home games and play them on the mainland? You know, have a stadium ban, but play it on the mainland, so you're not having to even risk them flying over to Bastia and, you know, the troubles that could take place between the trip from the, you know, airport to the stadium and back again. You know, after this game at the weekend, Lyon players got onto the coach at half time to go back, but because of the fears of what could happen, bang, they had to come off the coach and back into the dressing room. So, for me, if I was the LFP, I'd be looking at, why not? You know, there's only three or four home games left. play them on the mainland.
Yeah, okay. Very interesting. So we'll keep you updated with what happens with Bastia regardless. Lyon in a decent situation after turning around their Europa League title to qualify for the semi-finals. Let's talk about Nice, Rich, because they've secured that top three spot for the first time in 41 years, I understand. It doesn't mean, obviously, Champions League group stage qualification yet. If they finish third, it will be a playoff spot. But how have Nice, having lost their best player last summer in Hatem Ben Arfa, how have they achieved this under Lucien Favre?
To go back, not only did they lose Ben Arfa, they lost Valère Germain, who was only on loan from Monaco last season. They lost Nampalis Mendy, who moved to Leicester.
Sure, yeah.
So for what's actually taken place under Favre is spectacular. You know, they came out of the block. He came in. He'd obviously got a good, you know, decent reputation and was a, you know, quite a canny appointment. But he came in, transformed the side, really. Sort of played a slightly different formation. Was unafraid to be playing three at the back. You know, he took a bit of a gamble in bringing Balotelli in. But, you know, he brought Wieland Cyprian in from Ligue 2, who's one of the standout young players before he unfortunately suffered a really nasty-looking knee injury a couple of weeks ago. He's got the best out of Alisson player up front, quite a young player who perhaps was flattered to deceive, I think, for a couple of years. Got the best out of him. He seems to have allowed Balotelli only one or two sort of diva moments that we perhaps thought that Balotelli was going to be a bit of a, you know, was he going to be the Balotelli that sadly most people know him as? But he seems to have kept him under wraps for the most part. He, as I say, Favre just seems to have got the better. He has not brought in any Balotelli aside. He's not brought in any mega, you know, mega big names. He's not spent a huge amount of money. He's just got a really good core team. Balanced it very well with experienced players to marry up with the younger players that have been brought in or brought up through the youth system. So it's a remarkable achievement considering who they're above in the league and also then the top two and who they're still in competition with.
Let's talk about one of their star players, and it's Jean Siri who plays in the centre of midfield. Can you tell us why he's been such a great player this season?
I think for him, he's been given a bit more license to go forward. I think last season under Claude Puel, he played in a very talented midfield three alongside Mendy and alongside Vincent Cosiello. Cosiello seems to have fallen out of favour a little bit this year. Mendy's gone. Seri seems to be the sort of go-to man in midfield. As I say, he's been given license to get forward more. You know, he still has an element of defensive responsibility, but Favre has said, look, you've got the talent. You know, I want to try and push you further up the pitch. You know, it's no coincidence that, you know, a lot of people have tried to make the comparison between Seri and N'Golo Kanté. Seri himself prefers to model himself. I think he's gone on record as saying the kind of player he wants to model himself on is Xavi. And it's obviously a big player to be comparing yourself to. But you can see in the way that he plays, you know, some of these little inside passes and, you know, these hidden passes, I suppose, how Xavi used to have them labelled as. And it's come to great effect. You know, he's second in the assist ranking. He's getting more goals this season. Certainly in the last few games, his goals are probably the reason why you know, Lyon have finally now secured that top three spot. So, fantastic player, just been given a little bit more licence, I think, this season under Favre.
Yeah, he got a couple of goals at the weekend for Nice in a 3-1 victory over Nancy, which sees Nice stay within 1 point of Paris Saint-Germain. I mean, truly staggering. Paris Saint-Germain do have a game in hand, mind, as do Monaco, who are top. A nervy win, it felt like, at the weekend, Rich, for Monaco to get that 2-1 victory over Dijon with Falcao coming off the bench to score a wonderful free kick. Two wonderful free kicks from him, actually, in that game. One of them he scored.
Yeah.
How did Monaco obviously have this brilliant lead over Borussia Dortmund? Do you see them throwing that away in the Champions League?
You know what? I really don't. You know, it's going to be another game where they can't afford to sit back. I think they've perhaps been guilty of that a little bit in the league recently. Perhaps understandably so, considering sort of the position they're in. I think nerves are going to start to play a little factor considering the sort of age of some of those players. They're going to have Benjamin Mendy back from injury. They're going to have Bakayoko back from suspension. So they're going to be arguably having a stronger side. I can't see them throwing it away. I think the style of play that they do, and you know, you saw the performance against Manchester City in the previous round, where they really had to come out and actually get the result, which they did. There's perhaps less of an onus to do that on Wednesday night, but yeah, no, I do expect them to get through.
An excellent result for Monaco as they look to try and see out that Liga title and progress to the Champions League semi-finals as well. A quick one, Rich, I wanted to ask you about Marseille getting that win late on Sunday night. They got a 4-0 victory against Saint-Étienne. Florian Thauvin with a couple of goals and Payet scoring the last. Gomis, I mean, a real Premier League litany of players in there getting on the score sheet. Have you seen, since the change in ownership and the change in management with Rudy Garcia, have you seen an improvement in Marseille? They're sixth in the table at the moment.
I have. It's a very slow progress. It's nothing majorly significant. There have still been some pretty poor performances thrown in there. What Garcia seems to be doing now is finally getting the best from Tovar. You know, we Ligue 1 fans will remember how good he was in his sort of his breakout season with Bastia quite a few years ago, it seems now. And he seems to have been on a bit of a roller coaster, I suppose, since then. He had this sort of acrimonious move from Lille to Marseille initially, perhaps flattered to deceive at Marseille, but somehow got that big money move to Newcastle, where he again flattered to deceive, got his loan move back to Marseille. And this season, it's by far and away has been his best season. You know, he's looked strong on the ball. He's looked confident. He's not let his head drop. He's bringing a level of consistency to his game. So I think if any player sort of, I suppose, epitomises that change with Garcia coming in and the new owners coming in, you look at someone like Florian Thauvin. So it's a slow process. I've gone on record before saying this with Marseille. It's not going to be an overnight, you know, we're going to be winning the league. I think Marseille fans just need to temper that they have experienced quite a few years of sort of drama on and off the pitch. So I think they're just going to have to have a year or two just to settle in with these new owners. But yeah, no, great, you know, progress. But to be honest, looking at where they were last season, it'd have been pretty difficult to have gone backwards.
Yeah, very true indeed. I can't wait to see what they do in the summer transfer window, because I'm sure they're going to try and sign some Hollywood-style names. Rich, absolute pleasure having you on for the first time. Thank you so much for coming on Football in Europe.
No, thank you for having me.
That's all we have time for on Football in Europe this week. Remember to please leave us a review on iTunes. You can tweet us at FIE Podcast. We love getting your thoughts through the week, especially the ones criticising some of Chris's rubbish. So keep those coming in, and we'll see you again next Monday.
This is Football in Europe.